So in 1961, the British journal Mother and Child, the official organ of the National Council for Maternal and Child Welfare in Britain, reported on a mother and baby exhibition which included a special father's stand. The commentary began, "Perhaps the most significant pointer to the future development of parentcraft lay in the great interest taken by the husbands and fathers." The article pointed out that they were particularly interested in all forms of safety devices, which they said wasn't surprising, you know, men do things, make things. But it also commented on the fact that some had been present at the birth of the baby and concluded it was touching to see the interest shown in baby care by the husbands and the beatnik couples who came along. This is 1961. I can't go on. Often dressed in the same types of clothes and with almost the same hairstyles as their wives, they asked all the questions and bought the leaflets while their wives stood by as though the subject hardly concerned them at all. It certainly appeared to show at the council stand that the father has come to stay. In my talk today, I'm going to focus on the history of fathers and childbirth once childbirth moved into a hospital setting. In hospitals, fathers were initially excluded from the birth, but eventually infiltrated, or as Judith Levitt wrote, an American historian wrote, in her recent book on childbirth and fathers called Make Room for Daddy, they, quote, conquered all the important spaces of hospital obstetrics, or, to quote her again, wormed their way from outsider status in the waiting rooms into the inner sanctums of delivery and birthing rooms. Well, apart from Levitt's book, not a lot has been written on the history of fathers and childbirth, despite a growing literature on the history of fatherhood more generally. So today in my talk, I'm going to begin by exploring the movement which led to fathers' involvement, arguing that it was not a natural or obvious corollary of hospitalised childbirth, but rather the result of a particular movement based on a new psychology of the family. And then going on, I will go on to consider views of health professionals and mothers in particular, arguing that it was not a straightforward narrative of exclusion to inclusion, or of a consumer movement fighting against rigid hospital rules to allow fathers to be present. And finally, I will address the role of fathers once their attendance in the birthing room became the norm. Judith Levitt argues that not only did men increasingly attend birth, they, quote, gained in their ability to intervene in the birth process. She also argues that fathers' participation, to quote her again, did not create an egalitarian environment, rather it often reinforced both their own authority as head of the household and physicians' authority as medical experts. Now, in my talk today, I'm going to question whether this new development of fathers' involvement in childbirth really did reinforce or replicate existing gender inequalities, and what kind of control fathers actually did have in the birthing room. I'll be drawing a lot of my evidence from my research into the history of childbirth in New Zealand, but also with an eye to Britain. But just to start, I thought it would be useful for you to learn a bit about the history of childbirth and the move of birth into the hospital setting, focusing here on New Zealand. Now, hospitalisation of childbirth occurred earlier in New Zealand, actually, than many other Western countries, including Britain. By the mid-1930s, more than three-quarters of all births occurred in hospital. And this was before organised women's groups managed to persuade the first Labour government to introduce, as part of its universal health system, free hospital births in 1938. And a decade later, hospital births were almost universal in New Zealand. Now, women were attracted to hospital births once this option became available because of the public image of hospitals as modern and scientific. Childbirth was feared in the early 20th century, and it can't have been reassuring for New Zealand women to learn in 1918 that after the USA, they had the highest maternal mortality rate in the Western world. With their association with modern science, hospitals appeared to be a safer option than home birth, many thought. They also gained access to pain relief in hospital, and you might be surprised from a modern perspective that certainly in the 1930s, women's groups were adamant that pain relief was every woman's right. And finally, they chose to go to hospital because of the rest it provided from their domestic chores. So from 1939, they secured 14 days free care in hospital. And with the custom of babies being sent to the nursery and brought to mothers for 4-hourly feeds, mothers themselves could rest, knit baby clothes, eat their meals, and chat to the ladies in their journeying meals, journeying in the journeying beds as they recuperated from the birth. The hospital then was a medical and or a nursing establishment. There was no question of being accompanied into the hospital by husbands or other family members, nor did women find it an anomaly to be separated during childbirth in this way. As late as 1960, one woman wrote to the press, "I do feel childbirth is a woman's task. No man, however hard he may try, can understand the emotions involved in a woman's mind, nor can he ever know the joy and fulfillment of new life that he is denied, as likewise he is spared the pain." Similarly, in London in 1960, one woman declared, "As for having one's husband present at the birth, that's nonsense. Most men couldn't stand it, and that's a fact. My husband was visiting me when labour started, and I thought he'd never go away and leave me to it." A survey of a New Zealand maternity hospital around this time found that more than half of the 265 women surveyed did not want to have their husband present during the entire labour. Of course, this also meant that almost a half did. And the question itself was asked because of an activist movement which was gaining ground at this time, which was pressing for husbands to be present at childbirth in hospital. And I'm going to turn to that movement, that activist movement now. In 1951, a group of New Zealand women formed the Natural Childbirth Society, 6 years before a similar organisation was set up in Britain. In 1952, it changed its name to Parents' Centre to stress its consumer status and the involvement of both parents. And one of the goals of Parents' Centre was to allow husbands to be present when their wives gave birth in hospital. British obstetrician Grantley Dick Reid's books were an essential reference point for this new society. And he had a direct relationship with many New Zealanders owing to his extensive letter writing. In 1956, he wrote a letter to a local New Zealand paper in which he referred to, quote, "your readers from whom I have received so many letters of gratitude." Now, Dick Reid, some of you may be aware of him, some of you not, I don't know, but I'll explain. He began writing on natural childbirth already in the 1930s. He wrote about the importance of women consciously experiencing the birth of their babies and how to achieve this. By the 1950s, his movement had achieved cult status in New Zealand as elsewhere. His main concern was actually the long-term benefits of mother-infant bonding from the moment of birth. And in this, he was influenced by Sigmund Freud and his belief in the psychological importance of early life experience. Basically, Dick Reid believed that if women were relaxed and well prepared, they would not demand pain relief, but rather enjoy the experience of childbirth, which would foster a closer, more loving relationship with the baby, giving long-term psychological benefits for that baby. And he believed that men had an important role to play in it also in achieving a natural childbirth. Now, in his first book, in 1933, he described a successful natural childbirth. And I've put this up here. that he conducted. Half an hour after the baby was born, there was a knock on the door, following a heavy footstep. 6'4" of magnificent manhood pushed me out of the way. He had just returned from manoeuvres. His field boots were muddy. His spurs clanked across the room. He had a DSO and an MC, among other decorations. He had only one thought and one expression on his face: adoration. I went out, but understood. He contrasted this successful natural childbirth with another birth which was conducted under anaesthesia. He reported for the second one, a healthy child was delivered, alas, with forceps, and possibly no one left that house feeling more depressed and a greater failure than myself. I did not see her husband. He was something in the city. Now, it's hard to know what to make of this. It appears that having an adoring and very manly partner aided the woman to have a successful natural childbirth, whilst having a financier for a husband who showed no interest in the woman and the birth meant she had a miserable time and needed pain relief and instrumental delivery. Dick Reed also believed that preparing for and experiencing a natural childbirth together had far-reaching implications for a married couple. The obstetrician, he says, realises that his concern is not only to see the child into the world, but also enable these two people to be united in the most wonderful, awe-inspiring experience that can possibly fall to the lot of wedded human beings. The first cry of the child is shared by both husband and wife in almost unbelievable ecstasy. And he went on to say, this resulted in an association of marriage, which is indestructible for all time. I strongly advocate that all husbands should make the pregnancy of their wives a heaven-sent opportunity for an association in marriage at the highest level. Yes. In other words, he believed that future marital happiness was enormously advanced by father's participation in childbirth. And in his manuals and correspondence, Dick Reed also made plain what he believed were long-term consequences for families and even wider society of a natural childbirth, which husbands could help to achieve. For instance, in 1950, he told one mother that a baby born by natural childbirth, I have one more quote from him, he said, brings with it a fuller love and bondage which not only makes homes and families secure, but spreads its influence throughout society, which within a few generations bids fair to rid this world of the hideous turmoil which robs its people of so much happiness and freedom. So in this Cold War era of the post-Second World War, he saw families as a basis for future stability and natural childbirth as a way to that society. Now, there was a New Zealand psychiatrist called Dr. Bevan Brown, who had worked in London's Tavistock Clinic in the 1920s and 30s, who also brought back to New Zealand Dick Reed's ideas and became involved with the Parents' Centre movement. He had very similar views to Dick Reed in advocating natural childbirth. He explained at the first Dominion Conference of Parents' Centre in 1957 how natural childbirth, with its psychological benefits for babies, would lead to a better society. Interestingly, in his book he wrote, today's big question is how to develop a truly human society, not a race of robots or grown-up children. Natural childbirth, he said, provided the answer. And he wrote a manual on childbirth in 1950, which he called Sources of Love and Fear. And this included a section on fathers, in which he stressed their support role in achieving a natural childbirth. He even wrote, we might venture to add that in some circumstances he may have to protect her against too peremptory doctors or nurses. In other words, he was suggesting that the father's role was to ensure that the mother didn't renege on her plan to have a natural childbirth at the last minute. A third person who was involved in the 50s in this area was a woman called Helen Brew, this is in New Zealand, who was the first president of the Parents' Centre. And at the 1958 conference, On antenatal care, she presented a talk called The Parent's Viewpoint. She claimed that her first qualification to speak was that she had four children and had read all of Dick Reed's books. But she also chose to highlight her job as a speech therapist and referred to some case histories. She found, to quote her, a frequent pattern of traumatic childbirth leading to inadequate early nurture, which resulted in speech difficulties, especially stammering and associated behavioural problems. So the traumatic childbirth could have dramatic impact on the baby's future. And her husband, Quintet, who had helped her prepare her talk, she said, so that it included a father's perspective, he was also a psychologist. Helen Brew actually favoured home births, and she said at that conference in 1958, under that system, maternal and fetal death rates were high, but were not probably also the satisfactions of motherhood. You can make what you want of that. One of the problems with hospitals was, in her view, that fathers could not be present. Like Dick Reed and Bevan Brown, she believed that the birth experience affected the future psychological health of the baby as well as the relationship between the husband and wife. And this emphasis on the psychological value of home births, certainly, in critiques of hospitals continued in subsequent decades. In 1977, Helen Brew made a film with the Scottish psychiatrist R.D. Lang, whom some of you I'm sure have heard of, and actually you can access this film online. It's interesting to watch. In his commentary, Lang questioned how Western medical systems handled childbirth, which he categorised as, to quote him, one of the disaster areas of our culture. He argued that the conditions under which babies were born often led to the presentation of insanity later in life. And an article in the New Zealand Medical Journal in 1985 agreed with him, stressing the bonding, facilitation and loving circles created by gentle, family-centred birthing in the home, which the author believed may be an important part of our psychological and emotional salvation of the world. It's a far-reaching importance, this matter. This author advised, let's stem violence in at least one of its beginnings by giving the newborn the respect, gentleness and dignity in their introduction to the world, to this world. Fathers were to be part of that loving circle. Well, home births didn't take off in New Zealand as they didn't elsewhere either, but certainly Parent Centre did lobby hospitals to humanise, as they called it, hospital settings, including allowing fathers to be present during the birth. So now I'm just going to turn to the health professionals' responses to this new movement. When Christine Cole, one of the founders of Parent Centre, asked an eminent obstetrician if her husband could be present at the birth of her baby in 1950, he told her, indeed not, never heard anything so extraordinary. Once childbirth had moved into hospital and was managed by health professionals, mothers were treated like other so-called patients. A New Zealand obstetrician, Bernie Kyle, who joined the staff of National Women's in 1954, later explained that, bowing to a popular trend, he had allowed men to be present under strict conditions such as keeping to the top end of the bed, firmly telling them, don't come down here and have a peep show and tell me my job. Another obstetrician at National Women's, a rather conservative doctor called Dr. Pat Dunn, expanded on this in 1973. He said, from the point of view of the doctor, having the husband present leads to a second-rate service. I think all professional people realise that they do a better job if someone is not looking over their shoulder. In his view, childbearing is a private function of the body, and only the people who are really necessary, such as a doctor and nurses, should be there. It's partly a matter of professionalism, partly a matter of taste, he said. He later expanded on this view of childbirth as a so-called private function, explaining that with certain body functions which were private, he said the reproductive and excretory functions particularly. People realise that instinctively. It's like cleaning false teeth or putting on makeup. From the point of view of aesthetics and personal integrity, the woman deserves more respect. One recent American anthropological study on fathers and childbirth claimed that obstetricians resisted fathers' presence because this involved a clash of masculinities and power on the basis that, to quote the anthropologist, male obstetricians assert sexual power over birthing women. These doctors I've just quoted, who had reservations about fathers' presence, certainly did come across as paternalistic, but it is difficult to read any sexual underpinnings in their approach. Dunn was definitely old-fashioned, particularly in the permissive environment of the 1970s, but some women actually responded well to him. One woman later wrote she deliberately sought out Dr. Dunn because he was less judgmental than others. She declared, "Dr. Dunn has absolute regard for your dignity as a woman. He treated you like a queen." Doctors like Dunn complained that childbirth should not be turned into a public spectacle and that women's privacy and modesty should be respected. They also argued that that safety of mother and baby was their paramount consideration. An article in 1975 gave the example of an aircraft sign, "Keep out of the flight deck," explaining you don't protest that you have paid your fare and participation will bring you psychological benefits. Safety is the first concern of the professionals. He doubted whether the husband was prepared for a hemorrhage, a fit, an abnormal child, a stillbirth, or even the sight of his wife dying. This, he said, is the grim reality of obstetrics, and it calls for tough, resourceful, unsentimental nurses and doctors. In other words, in his view, childbirth was a medical and not a social event. However, such doctors, in New Zealand at least, and I suspect elsewhere also, were increasingly in a minority in the face of the popular demand, particularly by women themselves, for their husband's presence. In a 1960 lecture given at the opening of a new obstetric unit at Charing Cross Hospital, London, Professor Norman Morris stressed the importance of the emotional aspect of childbirth and the importance of staff realising this. And this was an increasingly common view, and in light of this, fathers were welcomed into the birthing room. In his 1964 inaugural lecture as Professor of Obstetrics at National Women's, London-trained Dennis Bonham declared that husbands should be allowed to be with their wives, not only during the first stage of labour, but also at the delivery. In his 1960 lecture, Professor Morris had quoted a woman's letter which stated, "Every woman realises that her husband is rather apprehensive the first time when he knows that his wife wants him with her. But it means secretly a lot to a woman that he did not choose to shirk what she could not shirk either." So those who did not attend were being called shirkers. And back in Auckland, Dr. Margaret Lilley, who was in charge of antenatal education, believed that women felt more secure in the presence of their husbands and pointed out that her husband had been present at the birth of all their five children between 1955 and 62. Well, Professor Bonham and others, in permitting husbands to be present, still laid down certain ground rules, though. I've got these here. Husband was to have attended an antenatal instruction or been present at his wife's previous confinement. He had to realise he was there to support, encourage and comfort his wife at the head end of the table and not as a spectator. He had to be properly garbed in gown and cap, gown, mask, overboots to conform with routine theatre technique, and he had to leave the delivery room immediately if asked. Here's a picture of a man who was properly gowned and obviously is quite good at, you know, learning how to wrap up the baby and handle the baby, which was very good, despite his rather stunned expression. And he had very good reason, actually, to have a stunned expression. His wife had just given birth to quadruplets. That was 1967. So by the early 70s, Bonham declared that the majority view in New Zealand was in favour of husbands being present at birth. Husbands were even allowed to attend caesarean births, particularly those conducted under epidurals, and he said, despite our initial anxiety, this appears to be working well. In a history of men and childbirth in America, Judith Levitt called caesarean sections the last frontier in denying men access to birth. While men were allowed to attend caesarean births, in 1981 this actually came up for discussion at a hospital committee medical committee meeting. This followed an incident in theatre when a husband had fainted and hurt himself. Discussing the case, the theatre supervisor explained, to quote her, "Male staff never wear identification, and with changing residence, it's difficult to tell staff from relatives or patients." This had clearly been a case of mistaken identity, with the husband doing more than he'd bargained for. Now, turning to accounts then of fathers' involvement, which once this became the norm, but first of all, taking it back a bit to the beginning of fathercraft classes to prepare them for this event. They began in New Zealand in the late 40s. In 1949, the head nurse of the infant welfare organisation there said that it was becoming the rule rather than the exception for expectant mothers to ask whether the classes could also be extended to their husbands. And a 1955 account of a fathercraft class treated fathers as rather shy and uncomfortable and simple, as the journalists set out to mock them. This is quite a long quote, but I think it's quite entertaining, so I'll read it to you anyway. First demonstration was how to tuck baby up in his bassinet, how to pick him up and put him down. The expectant fathers watched with self-conscious interest. Asked to try it themselves, the team hung back hesitantly. Then one, bolder than the rest, plunged forward. He handled the baby with the worried care of a halfback, putting the ball in a scrum right in front of his own goalpost. You must remember this is New Zealand. Rugby had to come into it. After that, it was plain as sailing. The team in groups picked baby up. The fathers-to-be, seated in a semicircle, were wrapped in interest as the we might was wrapped in a warm towel. The expectant fathers were by this time very proud of themselves, collectively and individually. Nevertheless, they looked rather worried and careworn after such a concentrated lecture. Okay, so fathercraft classes in the 50s consisted basically of bathing, making up milk mixtures, signs of commencing labour, and also making nursery furniture and safety on the home front. Auckland's head Plunkett nurse in the infant welfare that organised these classes said quite a number of the fathers come to measure the demonstration cot with a view to making a cot themselves. So that was their role. The nurses were instructed that in their talks there was to be no mention of sex and no mention of the actual birth. That was in the 50s. This was to change, of course, by the 60s, when mixed antenatal classes became the norm. Here's an antenatal class run by Sir William Lyley, who was famous for his work on fetal medicine in the early 60s, and this is early to mid-60s. By the 1970s, father's attendance was definitely becoming an expectation. A 1977 study by two female medical students surveyed childbirth at National Women's and at a rural hospital. And they wrote that it was interesting to note the large proportion of fathers present during labour at both centres. The only ones they said that weren't present was when the mother was single or separated. However, they also thought, and this is the late 70s, that it was interesting to note an increased reluctance on the part of the fathers to be there. One father at a rural hospital had been present at his wife's first delivery and stated he never wanted to be there again. And another got scared at the last minute, they wrote. And they also found one husband at that hospital who was prevented from being present by his wife. So that the birth experience was not always the joyous occasion, Dick Reed would have his readers believe. The scenario of husband's fainting was commented upon by enough staff to suggest it was not entirely a myth. Glenda Stimson, charge midwife at National Women's with 26 years of experience in midwifery, told a reporter in 1992 that she had seen the fainters. Those who slide slowly to the floor at the first sign of blood, those who buckle and crash, leaving their partners to go it alone. She recalled one guy keeled into the end of the bed, split his eyebrow, had to have 5 stitches and didn't see the delivery. Another fainted when the drip went in, got over to the caesarean theatre, fainted again, got concussion, was admitted to accident emergency. He was in shock and didn't see his baby until 6 hours later. She said, I've had men who say, I'll be all right because I've looked after sheep or cows, and then proceed to faint. She says it's quite different than it was their partner. Now, even Dick Reed himself, who believed that a husband's presence significantly advanced marital relationships, had some reservations once he had experienced father's involvement. He explained that the man had to be the right kind. He wrote, husbands are sometimes extremely sensible and understanding people, but a large number are a serious menace. He referred to the dangers of an anxious father whose anxiety would be transmitted to the mother and could prevent her from achieving a natural childbirth. And in the 1980s, a French doctor and natural childbirth advocate, Michel Audon, also thought that a particularly overprotective and possessive man could have a negative effect on labour. Again, Verna Murray, who was the principal nurse at National Women's from 1970 to 83, thought that having the father present at birth helped many women, but she believed that the man had to be the right type. She again recalled having to help several off the floor after they fainted during deliveries. Such concerns contributed to the continued insistence that fathers remain seated during delivery. In 1979, the delivery suite staff was advised, if husbands are present at delivery, they must be placed on a stool at the mother's right at the head of the table. They must not be standing or walking around the theatre, please. And a nurse in delivery suite, Elizabeth Wood, reminisced to me later about father's attendance in the 1980s. She said, I only had one man pass out, but added, some men are not greatly helpful during labour. Somehow they either ignore the wife or they overdo it and we have to say, go away, leave her alone. Or say, excuse me, we have a life-altering event here. We don't want to listen to the rugby, thank you very much. Fathers were also increasingly welcomed into the neonatal wards. Neonatal paediatrician Simon Rowley, who worked at National Women's from 84, commented that in the modern neonatal unit, you might see a father with his shirt off, with his baby on his chest. Admittedly, he continued to see gender differences, explaining the father seemed to be more interested in the technical aspects of the baby's care and the mother more interested in the pastoral aspects. So the father will come in and look at the monitors, the mother will come in and look at the babies. Okay, so now I'm just going to turn to women's responses. Did men perform their intended support role? Now, one women's organisation in 1980 did think that men should not have a choice in this matter. One of their recommendations was husbands must, I was quite surprised when I saw must, participate in antenatal education and assume equal responsibility for information gathering, support and exercising of choices. And one assumes that enough husbands did perform their intended support role as women continued to demand their presence, or was it simply becoming a social expectation? The 1992 article that quoted the midwife Glenda Stimson also claimed that sometimes men weren't that helpful even if they didn't faint. She said that conscious men can be just as much trouble. Often too intense, they arrive at hospital gripping stopwatches and white-knuckled fists, having timed every contraction to the 100th of a second. They know their partner's needs better than they do. They harass staff with questions and advice. I think you can get the tone from her comments was that she was quite dismissive of husbands. She did not take them seriously. And some overseas studies in the 1980s continued also to question whether husbands carried out their intended support role in delivery suite. A 1986 Scottish study by two midwives concluded that husbands remained marginal figures in the birth room. They wrote, they were treated as children might be, given a pretend role in the birth, e.g. allowed to cut the cord. and referred to as if they were spoilt babies unaware of the real world of women's lives. British feminist and childbirth educator Sheila Kitzinger also saw drawbacks with the system of allowing fathers to be present. She pointed out that allowing husbands to be present if they keep their place deprived women of having other women present, giving them less choice. And yet from the 70s, that choice did expand as hospitals began to open their doors to a broader range of support persons. In other words, husbands paved the way for other persons to attend. And in the 1980s, there was a new trend to open what were called ABCs, alternative birthing centres. Some of you might know of America had about 150 of these by the 1980s, and Levitt argued that these centres were the, quote, ultimate step in men's move through hospital spaces. But they also allowed access to other members, family members, to attend. National Women's had its first ABC, open an ABC in 1984, which had was a home-like comfort, it was described. It had piped music, coffee table, tea and coffee facilities, telephone, soft pink decor, leading to it be called the Pink Room. And I actually found a picture of the Pink Room in a magazine when I was looking. And the article on its opening explained that it was completed with the arrival of a $6,000 obstetric bed from Britain. That must be the one they're lying on. As it turned out, this wasn't quite very practical because apparently the bed was too big to be wheeled through the door if there was an emergency. So it could only be used by women who were definitely, seemed to be having a normal childbirth. But it was free of charge and it was part of the hospital system. It also had a spa bath, ensuite, easy boy, showcase room. But other rooms as well were becoming less sterile, and this was a trend that would definitely accelerate in the 1980s. So the hospital environment had changed significantly since the 1960s. The restrictions of earlier days in maternity hospitals had eased so much that couples were encouraged to bring items with them to make them feel more at home. As one male writer enthused in 1992, you can arrive with a picnic hamper, complete with champagne if you want. We've already sorted out 23 compact discs, 3 books, a magazine, champagne, chocolate bars, and a pot plant for our stay. Home-like. Okay, so to conclude then. Women pushed for their husband's presence, I think, as part of an attempt to humanise childbirth. And psychiatrists and psychologists provided a scientific rationale for that movement. The desire to have male partners rather than female companions was related to the ascendancy of the modern nuclear family, a legacy of the popular psychology emanating from Dick Reed, that future family relationships would be enormously improved by father's involvement from the very beginning, and the family would be the basis of a future stable society. So the mother, being conscious at the moment of birth and in the presence of the husband, was designed to foster good family relationships and responsible citizens. Fathers were to be part of that desire to create a better society, whether they liked it or not. Led by women, the natural childbirth and the psychology behind it had become a powerful social movement by the 1970s. While fathers' participation was inspired by the desire to strengthen the nuclear family, it did not, I found, reinforce family gender hierarchies, as Levitt had suggested, or as she put it, reinforce women's roles as mothers and fathers' role as breadwinners. Levitt herself showed how this gender division was breaking down, actually aided by fathers' involvement in childbirth, because one of the corollaries of men's involvement in childbirth was a greater involvement in child-rearing and emotional support of babies subsequently, i.e. breaking down conventional gender roles. Moreover, increasingly diverse support groups and persons were also participating in the birth, further breaking down traditional nuclear family models. By the 1990s, hospital spaces were accommodating a wider family presence, including parents, grandparents, and siblings. And to return to Levitt's argument that men increasingly had an influence over procedures in the birthing room, I found little evidence of this, and nor do I think did she provide convincing evidence. My own research lends more to supporting contrary findings, which Levitt included in her epilogue. For instance, to quote her, she said, "Significant numbers of fathers voiced feeling at sea, abandoned, out of control, when they entered into their wives' labour and delivery rooms." She quoted one psychiatrist who wrote of men who suffered something similar to post-traumatic stress disorder after attending their wives' delivery. And she also cited an anthropological study which regretted that rather than getting attention they might need, fathers were at the bottom of the list of important people in the birthing room. This anthropologist actually lamented that there were no notes in the chart about his progress, the father, no nurses bringing him lunch, no physician's consultation about his blood pressure, etc., etc. Fathers remained peripheral figures in the delivery room and support persons, as Levitt herself put it, in service to his family and his wife. But did they perform that support role to the satisfaction of their wives who had pushed for their presence? Well, in Auckland in 1991, one irate mother claimed her confinement at National Women's was ruined by the noise of unruly preschoolers dumped on other mums in the ward by dads who slouched all day in the TV room. The mother said, "The TV room is where a lot of mothers go to feed their babies, but often the room was full of men stretched out on the chairs who didn't even bother to get up and give you their seat." Some fathers were clearly not performing their intended support role, although in this instance I think these gentlemen probably would have been sorted out pretty promptly by the midwives in the ward. Thank you.